part of what's written in my book, but it's a little bit, we're going to expand on it a little bit more, and we'll try to make it much more practical to our lives as well. So something we've discussed many times, as I see a couple of my students here, and they know about it, is that we believe as people that, sadly to say, the human being has very limited eyesight. He's only, it's a phrase in a lot of the Svarim, a human is cursed that he only could see what is right before him. We are unable too often to see the surrounding events that are occurring in our own lives. Forget about in the world's lives, but in our own lives as well. And the famous example that I like to give is that when someone would stand in front of a mirror and he would hold up his right hand, they would be staring into the mirror at a perfect replica of themselves holding up their left hand. And even though if you would ask that person if they would only be visible in the mirror, means if a third party is looking only at the mirror and not at the actual person, and they would say, what hand is up? The person would be able to swear on a Sefer Torah and probably not be liable that they see a left hand going up. But we know the reality that the left hand is not the one going up. It's really the right hand that's going up, but the mirror flips it around. So there is this idea that when we are looking at things, sadly to say, we do not get to fully grasp all of the events that are occurring around it. In fact, not only do we not see the events that are going on while we're watching it, something I sometimes point out is that even if we know the events that occurred, and we know the resulting events that occurred, so you would say I have A, I could draw the line to B, it makes perfect sense. Usually, too often in that case as well, we misunderstood how the A got to the B. We're drawing the line, and the line is not the correct line at all. So one of the examples that I think I said many years ago, and it's in one of my books I published, is the story of the beginning of the Mussar movement. The legend goes that there was the reason Rabbi Saul Salanta pushed for the Mussar movement. At the time, it was a very controversial concept to have people studying as an official class, learning Mussar and self-improvement and stuff like that. People believed in that, but they didn't know it was an official thing. And what happened was, the legend goes, is that there was a person who was a poor person. He was a shoe cobbler or a shoe fixer, and he used to fix shoes for a living. And he was a very poor person in a small town in the middle of nowhere in Europe at all. No one really looked at him much. They came to him for the shoes, but he wasn't what was considered high stature of the society. And one day, someone knocks on his door and says, are you Mr. So-and-so? He says, yes. He said, you should know, it's like a dream. You had a second cousin that passed away from the big city, and he left over in his will that all the money should go to his closest relative. We've been looking for like 5 years to find a closest relative, and you're not going to believe it, it's you. The guy's like, I never even heard of this person. He said, yeah, it's a second cousin, but you should know, you are the person. And we have to go back to the big city to go to the court system and officially sanction it. But I'm telling you right now, it's going to be you. Of course, the lawyer takes his cut, but we go back in time. And the fact is, you're going to be now a very, 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 very wealthy person. And it proves all true. Even though it sounds like a Nigerian scam, it proves all true. The person was able to go and provide the information that proved that he was the second cousin. And that was at that point in time, the closest living relative to the person who passed away. And all of a sudden, overnight, the person went from a shoe cobbler to one of the wealthiest person around. And it happened to have been that he had a daughter that was dating at the time. This daughter, who was valued as the daughter of a shoe cobbler, not to make fun, but now she became the daughter of the person who now was the richest guy in the small town. And what he did was, he right away made a very nice shidduch. He got a person from a town over, was also wealthy and had yichus and had everything going for him. And his daughter now was engaged to this boy from the next town over, who was considered the superstar for the last couple of years, based on lineage, based on monetary status, based on brains, based on every asset that we would be judging people. And it came toward the wedding, and the wedding was in the girl's town, and all the grand rabbis from all the neighboring cities came, because they were all related to this new mechutin of his, and they both were considered now wealthy to a wealthy shidduch, and everyone was showing up to the wedding. And as the wedding was going on, it was a very fancy wedding, one of the people sitting there couldn't deal with it. This was the guy who was next to him, and surely didn't look at the guy for years, and he can't believe that this guy now has the nicest wedding around, and it bothered the guy. And as he was sitting there eating the steak, and the steak sauce was dripping down his mouth, he just couldn't hold himself back. So in the middle of the first dance, he decided he was going to get his sweet revenge and prove to everyone what's going on here, and he took off his shoes, and he jumped into the middle of the circle, and he began dancing with the chassan and the kala. And then when the kala's father came toward the middle to dance, he jumped in front of him, he says, "No. Do me a favor, I've been dancing, I ruined my shoe. You're the shoe man, can you fix my shoes?" And the other side had no idea. They had whitewashed his original past. They had looked at him as now a wealthy donor and a very successful person in many areas. And they turned to the mechutin and they said, "What is this guy talking about? What does he mean, fix my shoes? What does that even mean?" And as this is going on, the person who was angry and bitter said to the crowd, what do you mean? You didn't know up until a year ago, this guy was used to fix shoes for a living. Then he got somewhere else to get money. And the embarrassment and the shock to the mechutan that at his own daughter's wedding, in front of all these grand people, he could have faced such an embarrassing moment. He fainted and he passed away. And that was the impetus to begin the Musa movement. This is what the legend says. And at the time, the story had got around. Everyone knew about it and it became a big thing. They said, you know, we're going to start a Musa movement. And one of the grand rabbis of about 110 years ago, which is about 25 years after the story happened, he said this idea, what I was trying to stress before. We know the event was the wedding and the person being embarrassed, and we know the result was now the Muslim movement began. And if we asked everyone on the Zoom, if we stopped people on the street and we'd ask them, what connects this direct line between the person acting this way at that wedding and the Muslim movement beginning, everyone would say, because the chutzpah of a guy who's eating steak at someone's wedding can go into a middle of a dance and it has nothing to do with him, and just to try to embarrass someone, to break up a shidduch for no reason whatsoever, that's why the Muslim movement now began. People needed to know what their self-evaluation was correct and why they're upset, why they're angry, why they feel the need to embarrass people. That's what I think most of the people here, Marg, am I right? Is that what most of the people would say the Zoom is? But the answer is that is not this rabbi from about 25 years after this event occurred. That it was not the impetus for the movement. The story is true, the result is true, but the point is that we have the whole middle wrong, sadly to say. And he said the reason was like this. For the guy himself, who's an angry, crazy person who goes into the middle of a dance and embarrasses the Kala's father, we don't have to wait for that event for Musa to happen. We don't wait for the worst thing to happen for Musa to happen. As well, a person who could do that, I don't know if Musa will help that guy enough. Clearly, there's something off a little bit by a guy who could walk into a wedding holding his old shoe, trying to embarrass him. He said that was not the reason for the Muslim movement. The reason the Muslim movement began because of this story was because of the Kala's father. The Kala's father, who at one point, in this, what we consider in the Shidduchim world, but obviously we don't say that, but in other words, just a shoe cobbler, and therefore he had what would not be considered a very attractive Shidduch, now went by sheer luck. He did nothing. He did nothing to earn anything. God sent him a gift of a second cousin he had never met that had passed away, and God created a whole situation where now he was considered wealthy, he was considered valuable, in the chashuv. He was able to make a Shidduch like this, and he's dancing at a wedding. What he should have done, to quote this rabbi from 25 years after the events occurred, he should have taken the shoe from the bitter, angry person and kissed it. He should have said, that was my life, and now look where I got to. I'm at a wedding where I made such a great shidduch. But instead, his reaction of some bitter person showing him his past life had the reverse reaction, where he was so offended, so insulted, so distraught, that he was able to actually have a heart attack and pass away, meant that person needed Musa. That person had to recognize what life was about, recognize what God had given him, but recognize what things are about, and that's why the Muslim movement began. That's really more of an introduction. That's a story quoted in my other book, but that's more of an introduction to life that I've always say, that sadly to say, too often, and I, when I say too often, I mean over the 90%. Over the 90% of the time in our lives, even if we get lucky enough to branch out and see a bigger picture in front of us, not only do we only not see what's right there, we can branch out. Too often we know the beginning, we know the end, and we still have the line incorrect, sadly to say. And we have to work on that. And we have to usually use our brains to try to see the variables between the two lines that we made the assumption, but they're not necessarily true. As they have the American phrase, round up the usual suspects. We have to be bigger than that and not round up the usual suspects. We have to look at a bigger picture, and usually we have to go to greater people than ourselves to see the bigger picture. If you get to Gedolim, one of the things I like to always point out is that we are in the phrases in Judaism, we are very specific. So we refer to our great leaders as Gedolim. Gedolim means big, large. It's an odd phrase. We would assume the Gemara refers to them as Chachamim, right? From the Agadah, we call them the Chacham. Sometimes we refer to them as Tzaddikim. But nowadays, it seems like the phrase is Gedolim. G-E-D-O-L-I-M. Why would that be the phrase? And once I was speaking to a big rabbi, one of the Gedolim, and it came out that sometimes the word Gedolim means because you have to branch out and see the bigger picture. The Gedolim means the view. He has a view that he gets to see more than what we're looking at. Although we're connecting the two dots, and it sounds very impressive, and it would sound very simple, too often we're looking at the wrong two dots. We're looking at the crazy person who actually took off his shoe at a wedding and went over to the person, when really we should be focusing on the other part of the picture, which is the father of the bride. And in general, we have to know that. So now we're going to discuss the story of Kamta Bar Kamta a little bit, and hopefully through that story, and with a little bit of a spin on it, we're going to realize that even though the story says A and it gets to B, the dots that we connected might not be correct. So The very, very basic story of Kamsa bar Kamsa is the Gemara says that through the story of Kamsa bar Kamsa, Yerushalayim was destroyed. Yerushalayim is actually, obviously, inclusive of the Beis HaMikdash itself. Although it says Yerushalayim, it means the Beis HaMikdash itself. What was the story of Kamsa bar Kamsa, which we learn as kids? And every word in the Gemara, as we like to say, is I don't want to say back Lawrence because it's the wrong crowd here, but it's very valuable real estate. Very valuable real estate. There is no letter, no word, no phrase in the Gemara that does not have multiple meanings on multiple levels that most of the time we'll never get to the end of it. The Torah is endless. It's beyond our comprehension. But we have to do what we could do. We not only analyze the words that are there, but the great ones analyze the words that are not there as well. So when we look at something and there's a story in a Gemara, it might be a simple story as well, but every detail in the story that's quoted has to mean something for us today, or else the rabbis of 2,000 years ago clearly would have left out those details of the story. And on the reverse end of it, the details that are left out, the rabbis left it out, and we would think it's important, means they're as well trying to teach us a lesson. Now, just because Mrs. Thakatinsky told me beforehand that there is a rumor going around that I speak quickly, I don't know if that's true at all, but there is a rumor that I do speak quickly. She told me every few minutes I should just make sure that no one should feel shy, and they should undo their mute button if they have any questions whatsoever. So if there are any questions whatsoever up until now, we will give the audience a few seconds to unmute themselves, because sometimes you have to figure out how to do it, and ask a question until now. Is anyone texting you, Mrs. Akatinsky, saying, I don't know how to unmute myself? No. Okay. So let's go through the big...
Star what? Six. I think it's star six if you want to unmute.
Huh? I have no idea. Okay. So now we'll go like this. So this, the basic story of Kamsa by Kamsa is like this. In Yerushalayim, doesn't say in Yerushalayim, but that's probably a hint that in other areas of the story, so we're going to assume that's what it means, but it does not say the first words I just said. In Yerushalayim, there was a person. We'll call him the host. There was a host, and he was making a grand party. Does not give the details of what the party was about, and that is something discussed by the authorities, the commentators, but we're not going to discuss that today. And he was making a grand party. And this host had two acquaintances, one very positive, one very negative. He had someone, Kamsa, that he liked a lot. And unbelievably, he had an enemy that was called Bar Kamsa. Bar Kamsa and him did not get along at all. So there was a Kamsa, which is an interesting name itself. There was a Kamsa that he liked, and a Bar Kamsa that he did not like. And he told the invitation people to do me a favor, send out the invitations. Now, it seems to be that there was a mix-up in the invitation. And Bar Kamsa, the enemy, the sworn enemy of the host, gets the invitation to this lavish, expensive ball. And he decides he's going to go. Bar Kamsa shows up to the party. Now, we're not sure if Kamsa showed up to the party. In fact, just because Mrs. Akatinsky, now I said her name, in this book that I wrote a few years ago, Experience Greatness, I do discuss if Kamsa ever showed up to the party. It's a very big question about Kamsa, but we're not discussing Kamsa today. So Bar Kamsa definitely showed up to the party, and he got the invitation that he was not supposed to get. Kamsa, who never received an invitation, the question is, did he show up without an invitation, or did he stand on ceremony and not show up without an invitation, even though he knew he was great friends with the host? So the enemy shows up, and the friend does not show up. The story continues. The host approaches the enemy and says, what are you doing here? We are enemies. Now, that's a very, very interesting opening phrase. Imagine you're sitting at a party, whether you like the host or don't like the host, and instead of hearing a hello, how you doing, how is traffic, you're late, what's the food like, do you like what's going on? This is the approach of the host. We are enemies. Very bad opening line by the host. Sounds like he's looking for a fight, if you ask my opinion. A very unfavorable opening line shot, as they say, opening shots fired by the host toward this Bar Kamsa. Bar Kamsa's reaction is, you know what, I hear it was a mix-up. Now, why Bar Kamsa showed up to the party? Very fascinating. Did he think he was invited, or did he not think he was invited? So both of these questions have to be answered. Kamsa, did he show up by not getting an invitation? And Bar Kamsa, when he did show up, did he think he belonged there? If he didn't think he belonged there, it's very strange he showed up. If he did think he belonged there, he should have been nice enough to say, wow, here's my sworn enemy, because the Gemara seems to make it was an obvious known fact that they were enemies. Here's my sworn enemy inviting me to a party. I'm going to show up. A little odd. You show up to the party, you don't say hello to the host either. A little strange. The host approaches his enemy and says, listen, Bar Kamsa, we are no longer friends. We never were friends. We are enemies. You knew we were enemies. Please leave. So Bar Kamsa says, listen, I don't want to embarrass myself. I'm enjoying the food here. I already had some food. You know what? No big deal. Let me pay for my own portion. How much does it cost for one meal? I don't know how much meals costed in Jerusalem a couple thousand years ago. Today, I think in the wedding hall, depends where you go. Anyway, I don't want to give numbers here because they might be out of my price range. But anyway, let me pay for my meal. The host, being who he is, says, no deal. No deal. Oh, that's interesting. So Bar Kamsa's feeling the pressure, a little under his tie. He's like fixing it. He's like, oh, what do I do now? He says, okay, you know what? I'll pay for half the meal of the entire event. That means whatever the bill costs at the end, when the caterer comes to you, I pay half. And the host says, no deal. So Bar Kamsa figures this is a negotiation. He figures, okay, I guess you're playing hardball. Let me go for it all. He says, I will pay for the entire thing. Three offers. I pay for my own meal. I pay for half the meal. And now I'm paying for the entire meal of the entire event. Imagine that. By the way, if any of you consider yourself an enemy of mine, when I make a wedding, if you want to come and pay for the whole thing, I invite you. I invite you to come and pay for it. I'm fine. I will not throw you out. I will actually hug you if you want to pay for my entire wedding. It's fine by me. Any party, actually. You don't have to be a wedding. Any party I make, if you come and say, I'm your enemy, but I'll pay for it, I will take that deal. But the host did not take that deal. The host actually threw him out. Physically picked him up and threw him out. Now, Bar Kamsa's reaction is very, very upset. As we can imagine, he felt he was embarrassed. This was the event of the year. It says all the rabbis were there. Now it says it, didn't say it earlier. All the rabbis were there. And he said, you know what? The rabbis are there. The rabbis didn't stop this. Now, it's not so clear the rabbis heard the event, but he assumed they did. The rabbis are there. The rabbis heard the event. And you know what? I'm going to get revenge. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to set up a certain sequence of events that's going to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. And he runs to the authorities and he bribes himself to get in there, and he gets in there and he proves them that the Jews are considered a rebellious nation. And through his actions, we are sitting here today. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Now, many number of questions are vital to us today. We know as Jews from the Gemara and Tainus, any generation that does not have the Beis HaMikdash rebuilt in their generation, they are equal to the ones who destroyed it. That means you could look at it like this. The actual sin of destroying the Beis HaMikdash has to be on this level. But to rebuild it, we're going to have to move much higher because now it doesn't exist anymore. Talmud says, no, it's the exact same level. So if let's say last year, of course not this year because we have 3 days to bring Mashiach, but last year, let's say, I would tell you, how bad are the Jews last year? So we would want to speak good about the Jews in the 9 days. Don't want to speak bad about the Jews ever, but certainly not in the 9 days. Some people would tell you, some rabbis in the Gemara will tell you, if the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt, it's the exact same status. The same status that takes to destroy it is the same status to rebuild. The Beis HaMikdash is available. It's actually built, waiting for us. All we got to do is reverse the sins of our past. Which sins? Kamsa bar kamsa. That's what it seems to say. If I would ask anyone in this room right here, do you believe you are capable of being insulted and taking revenge? We call an American phrase today, disproportionate revenge. Are you going to take revenge on the entire Klal Yisrael? Highly unlikely. Even if I was to embarrass somebody, which I never would, as my students know, I would never embarrass a person in public as they're looking on. But if I would embarrass someone in public, God forbid, which I never would that person ever turn around and say, I will destroy all of Judaism? Thankfully, none of my former students have ever said that at all. None of them. So clearly, you see that the idea is Bar Kamsa is a bad person. Okay, but I ask you like this. Is the host a good person? The host is not. Does not sound like a very nice person. The host went over to a guy, introduces himself by saying, we are sworn enemies. The ultimate of insult. The host has offered three different offers, negotiation play to get rid of this person in a nice way. Let him sit there by himself in the corner like he was doing the whole time. Bar Kamsa walked in and he was ignoring everybody. Let him sit and ignore everybody again. Let him sit in the corner and let it work. He'll pay for the whole meal. What do you lose? He threw him out. I don't know if the rabbis did anything wrong or not yet, but I will say one thing. Whether the rabbis at the time heard what was occurring and didn't stop it, I don't know. But I am sure, without the TMZ existing at that time, I am sure that as soon as Bar Kamsa was ceremonially thrown out and he said he's going to go to the authorities, I'm sure the news came out why Bar Kamsa was upset. In any part of the story, do we see the rabbis approaching the host and saying, by the way, bad job. Maybe go ask the guy, Mechila. Pretty bad thing. Why'd you throw the guy out? He did offer to pay for the whole thing. And even if he didn't pay for the whole thing, who cares? The guy was sitting there. What do you got to be so aggressive for? Enjoy your own party. Like we said with the Muslim movement before. You're sitting at a party. All the rabbis are there. What are you doing? It's a bad move. Why are you focusing on that one guy who you don't like? Focus on the other 99% who seem to like you and eating your food. So if you would have to ask a question, you would say that the bad people in the story, okay, Bar Kamsa's not a great guy. I got to be honest. He's not that good a guy. Doesn't look good here. But the bad guy in the story would be the host. He would be equal, if not greater, as a bad guy than Bar Kamsa. If, of course, as we know from my students, we would never make fun of rabbis, because my students treat me with such great respect. If you see one of them laughing on camera, you realize that that's not true necessarily. But we definitely don't always treat the rabbis with respect. But were the rabbis here? Were they as bad? They couldn't give this guy, the host, any musa whatsoever? Why, when we discuss the destruction of the temple, we blame Kamsa? I don't know what Kamsa did at all here. Was Kamsa involved at all? I'm not even sure. Kamsa seems like he has nothing to do with the story in reality, except having a bad first name or last name. I'm not sure if Kamsa's first name or last name. But besides having the name similar to a bad person, I don't know why he should be thrown out of anything here. And we say the bad people in the story are Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. And I might add, it means the Gemara is telling all of us here right now, we are equal to the task of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Because had we not been as bad as Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, we would have a base of English today. So what we want to do now is we want to discuss, analyze the story and see how, even though we got from A to B, we made a big mistake here, and figure out how this mistake is still applicable to us today in many ways. So again, the main questions we're asking is Bar Kamsa that guy, that bad a guy? He doesn't seem great, doesn't seem that bad. More so, the host seems terrible. I don't know why we nicknamed the host, the blank, the host. Let's give him an actual name. Let's say the host and Mr. So-and-so. Let his name live in infamy as well. Why should we blame Bar Kamsa forever and ever? Everyone knows the name Bar Kamsa now, whether you knew it before this class or not. We all know how bad a guy he is. What's the difference? What about let's know the name of the host? He doesn't seem like too good a guy as well. So that is the basic question. And I might add, let's throw the names of the Rabbanon out there. Let's say, you know what? Rabbi so-and-so was there, and he sat there, he watched the entire event. He didn't do anything. And if he didn't hear the entire event because he was too busy talking to someone, he knew about it the next few days afterward. It doesn't take a 20 minutes to go from being thrown out of a party to getting the Roman government to destroy you. So clearly some time took place. Was there any Muslim movement involved whatsoever here? That is our question. Everyone following so far? Okay. No questions as of now. And now we're going to say a different part of the story that works out. And this part is a detail that I think is very, very vital to us understanding, sadly to say, not anyone on the Zoom who would come at 10 o'clock in the morning to a shir, but other people necessarily are a part of this problem. And we have to fix this problem in the next 3 days. So we have the Messianic revelation before Tisha B'Av arrives, and we get to sing Megillas Eicha instead of moaning on the floor, putting eggshells, ashes on our head. We get to sing it, hopefully. So this is part of the story I want to say. The Yerushalmi brings down, the Jerusalem Talmud brings down, that the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, not only because of baseless hatred. That's what we would say if I would ask him why the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. Baseless hatred. Nothing to do with Kamsa Bar Kamsa. Baseless hatred. Not only because of that, but the Yerushalmi says, because the people loved money. They loved money. And according to many of the commentaries, that love of money was really the root of baseless hatred. They bring down the Aras Tavash, Rav Yonasan Eibschitz, 1600s. He says like this. He says, the fact is that when I am happy with my money, I don't hate anybody else. I'm content. I'm in a good place in life. I get to have my ice cream in the morning. All is good in life. But when I'm unhappy with the amount of money I have, or I look at someone else with more money than me, that creates a sinister character. That creates negative feelings. Half glass empty, not half full. And that creates negative vibe. And that creates baseless hatred toward other people. So the what really was the cause of baseless hatred, according to the Aras Tavash, not according to me, the cause of baseless hatred was the fact was that they loved money. Now, the idea of loving money to create bad things is something that possibly, which we'll see now in this story as well, is something that we have to work on till today. Do I think anyone here in the room has baseless hatred? As I've said many times in my life, there's no such thing as baseless hatred. If you have an enemy, God forbid if you do have an enemy, believe me, you have many reasons why you hate that person. It's never baseless. There's always a good amount of reasons. I have never met someone in my life, really, who says, I hate that person for no reason whatsoever. Very unlikely. Sometimes it happens with staff members in a school. But usually, even then, there is a reason. If they walk into the room, they say, I hate the teacher. But usually because they decided that teacher is going to be a bad person. But there's no real reason as a concept of what's called baseless hatred. So when we say the business was destroyed because of baseless hatred, then I turn to everyone on the Zoom and I say, guys, we got to fix this up before Tisha B'Av. Everyone in the Zoom is going to say with pure confidence, which I wouldn't blame you, because you'd probably be right, you are not violating baseless hatred at all. There is nobody you hate. That's what you would say publicly, even though that's not true. But you would say, there's nobody I hate baselessly. That for sure you would say. So let's get this straight. There's no such thing as baseless hatred. The Talmud Yerushalmi says that baseless hatred really means a love of money. When you love money, you create the negative feelings toward others. That's not really fair. If you believe in Hashem, you believe Hashem is mastering everything in the world, then you believe you got exactly what you deserve. Nothing more, nothing less. That person's money has no effect on your life whatsoever. You can't steal it, you can't take it, because Hashem has it all mapped out. But it creates a negative feeling. So what we have to do is work on, within this story, we're going to see how money played a role in the event. Now, it does not say, back to the Kamsa Bar Kamsa story, it does not say why they were enemies. It doesn't say who was right and who was wrong. Usually it takes two to tango, but I don't know who was right and who was wrong. Let's look at the situation and try to analyze the story that was there. The analyzer story says that the rabbis showed up to the party and that the party was located, most probably, in Yerushalayim itself. Now, there is a Mishnah that tells us a fascinating idea. The Mishnah says that the rabbis of Yerushalayim, called the Nekiyei Hadas, the high-minded people, but it was said as a complimentary thing, high-minded people of Jerusalem would never go to a party unless they knew all of the guests that were there. They would never show up to a party unless they knew who was 100% invited. They're not going to sit next to someone, on an extreme American example, who might say something inappropriate, and they're standing there and listen to it. We do not have full control over what we hear in life. We have control over our arms. We have control over our legs. Most of us, thank God. But we do not have control of what we hear. We do not have control of what we see. We have some control, but not full control. You can be walking down the street, and a firecracker goes off and scares you. You had no control to not hear that firecracker. No such thing. If you are sleeping and I scream into your ear, wake up, good chance you're going to wake up. Depends how loud I scream. You're going to wake up. Depends on you, also if you're in high school or not. High school kids seem to be able to live through the screaming and not wake up. But normal human beings, somehow, high school kids are not, normal human beings are capable of waking up when someone screams in their ear. You have no choice on all of what you hear. A Nekei Das of Jerusalem would not go to a party based on the fact that he did not know everyone involved. He does not want to take a chance at listening to something he shouldn't listen. He does not want to take a chance at seeing something he should not see. So they were very, very, very strict on who they went to parties with. That means when you would send an invitation to a Nekei Das rabbi, this would be his response back. Let me check my schedule. By the way, could I have the invitation list? Could I see the guest list? Because if the guest list is not up to my standards, I'm sorry, nothing personal against you, but I cannot go. And although it might seem a little snobbery, the Talmud explains why this is a brilliant, great idea on many, many levels. And we're just giving the simplest one. They will never be accidentally hearing or seeing something they should not accidentally hear or see. And they would make sure. So if you had a guest right now in the fight between the host and Bar Kamsa, which we said Bar Kamsa looks like a little bit of a victim here because he was publicly, ceremoniously thrown out in public. But the host, we don't know much about this guy. Would you think the host is a good guy or a bad guy? And I will give you one hint. First hint is all the rabbis showed up to his party. You know what that tells me? That tells me that the host must not be that bad a guy. That must be that they realize that the host might be a victim in the situation of the fight. Maybe Bar Kamsa sold him trade food for many years and he didn't realize it. Maybe Bar Kamsa violated his family. Maybe he stole money from him 100% innocently on the host. The host, in the case of the host versus Bar Kamsa, if we had to make an approach right now, who is guilty, host versus Bar Kamsa, it could be that the fact that all the rabbis showed up to the host's house, it could be that that means that the host was really not a bad guy. Because if he was a bad guy, they wouldn't show. Margo, is that a question?
But they got all the rabbis got the guest list, and Bar Kamsa was on the guest list, so he must not be a bad guy either.
Wrong. Bar Kamsa was not on the guest list. Kamsa was on the guest list. There was a mistake. Do you remember the beginning of the story? The wrong guy, Bar Kamsa, showed up, but he was not supposed to show up.
Right.
So Kamsa, we don't know anything about this guy, Kamsa. We said he might be nobody. But Kamsa clearly wasn't that bad a guy because the invitation list said Kamsa and the rabbi said Kamsa's good enough. I don't know, by the way, I don't know if Bar Kamsa would have been on the list if the rabbis would have shown up. I can't tell you that. The rabbis were there and Bar Kamsa was there. But Bar Kamsa was not on the guest list originally and he showed up. So what happens here is you have a party where all the rabbis show up and they trust the host enough. They trust his kashrus. They're eating his food. They trust his guest list because they're there. So it seems like if we have to start making a guess, the host is not that bad a guy, the rabbi showed up. Bar Kamsa, well, he looks like he got brutalized here, but the fact is Bar Kamsa in the end proved he's not that good a guy because the fact is Bar Kamsa went and destroyed, we said disproportionate retaliation against the entire Jews because one person might have insulted him and maybe the rabbis. So he's clearly not a good guy and we're beginning by saying maybe the host is not a good guy. But we ask an obvious question. This is the question I thought Margo would ask. How good could the host be? He threw the guy out of his house. Doesn't seem so nice. How good could the host be when he comes over to the person and instead of being a friend of me and pretending to smile at all the jokes, pretending to be friends with them, a real high school thing, instead they come over and they say, listen, we're enemies. What type of statement is that? We're enemies. What type? And why are you turning on the guy's money? So let me tell you what one approach might be. One approach might be is that when the host approached Bar Kamsa, what he was doing is based on a Gemara. There's a fascinating Gemara, which I've said over in some of my classes. It's very, very difficult to do, by the way. The Gemara in Yuma on 87a brings down several stories of rabbis who were victims. And what they did was they went to the perpetrator and tried to get the perpetrator to ask forgiveness, which means A did something wrong to B, but instead of B didn't ask Mechila, but B goes to A to give him the opportunity, walk by his house, let him see him, he's humble, hopefully creating the atmosphere where A will say, you know what, at one point we were friends, I remember this guy, let me ask forgiveness. And there's a concept in Judaism, the Sfasemis brings down, a concept in Judaism, that even if you're the wronged party, 100% the wrong party, there is a concept to try to make peace, and try to make the perpetrator ask forgiveness. You can't be friends again, but ask forgiveness, and this is something that people would do, Erev Yom Kippur as well, and try to make peace. That means even when someone is a victim. So, but how do you do it? Here we would say it like this. The host is approaching Bar Kamsa, and he wants to remind Bar Kamsa By the way, we're not friends. I sent you the invitation. It was a mistake. I'm not sure what you thought about the invitation. I'm not sure if you thought the invitation was a mistake or you got the invitation on purpose. But either way, I want to tell you right now, we are not friends. And what he was hoping to do, what he was hoping to do is have Barkhamsa say, you know what, you're right, but you didn't get to invite me, either by mistake or not. There's two different ways to read this story. But you know what, you did invite me, and I am sitting here. Let's be friends. Let me ask you forgiveness. I sold you the bad food. I stole from you. I did X. I made fun of you. I ruined the shidduch of your daughters. Whatever terrible things we can think of. You know what? I was wrong. You were right. I know that. We are enemies, but really we're not enemies. It's all on me. I ask you forgiveness. That's what the host is hoping he would do. Hoping you do. You know what Barkhamsa's response was? I'll pay for my own meal. Instead of me asking forgiveness, I'd rather throw my money around. Let me pay for myself. You know what it takes to ask for forgiveness? So thankfully here, nobody on the Zoom would ever done anything wrong in their life. They would ever need to ask forgiveness. But me, I can't say that about myself. I've done things wrong in my life, and I have to ask forgiveness sometimes. Very, very not easy to do. So would I want to ask forgiveness or pay for my own meal at $8 a meal? I'll pay the $8. So he says, you know what, host, we are enemies. You're telling me let's be friends. I'm not ready to do that. You know what, I have a good idea. Can I pay for my meal? The host says, no. Not a good idea. Then Barkhamsa says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to up the deal. I'm going to up it to half the meal of the entire place. Let me pay half the place. What he's saying is, he's not being a good guy. When we began the story, it looks like Barkhamsa is a good guy. He's upping to what he's willing to pay, just not to be embarrassed. That's not what he's doing here, Barkhamsa. What Barkhamsa is doing here is, he's upping the ante in order to avoid saying, I'm sorry. That's not a good thing. That's a terrible thing. Terrible. He would rather pay for half the price of the entire meal, of the whole place, in order not to say, I'm sorry. The host says, nope, no good. Sorry, not good enough. I'm not looking for your money. I'm looking for you to apologize, which many of us could hear us saying, right? Can't you say that to someone? It's not about money. Apologize. You broke my daughter's shidduch, God forbid. You stole a job from me. You got me fired, whatever it is. And now what Barkhamsa says is, no. You know what? You're right. You're right. Half the meal. I apologize. Half the meal. My apology is not that I did something wrong to you. My apology, I only offer half the meal. I'll pay for everything. It's all on me. All on me. Now, if you're a victim of a guy's crime, guy Godfrey broke up a shidduch of yours, got you fired from a job, and he tells you, you know what, I'm not going to apologize for that, but I'll pay for the whole meal. No. Many people are going to say, I don't want you paying for the whole meal. I already paid for this meal. I am fine with that. I got the rabbis here. I don't want you at this place. You're a person who's not capable of saying I'm sorry. You're a person who's not understanding that you paying for things is just making the insult greater. Get out of my party. And he threw him out. Is the host a bad guy? I don't know. I don't think he's bad at all. He's trying to teach this guy a lesson. Don't throw your money around and try to make yourself successful and avoid the sins you're doing. No, say I'm sorry. That's more important. And I'll tell you something amazing. If you are a perpetrator, not a victim, you're a perpetrator, you're supposed to ask forgiveness from the victim. So let's say, God forbid, you did something, not you, someone, A, Mr. A did something terrible to Mr. B. And now Mr. A says, you know what, Erev Yom Kippur, I feel bad, maybe I shouldn't have done that. You know what, let me go apologize to Mr. B. Goes to the house, gets out of the car, rings the doorbell, Mr. B answers and says, what are you doing at my house? He says, you know, Erev Yom Kippur, I feel bad, I want to apologize. And B says, well, we're not going to say what B says, we're on a Zoom, we're being recorded. But clearly not using proper words, not using proper language, B slams the door on A. What does A do? According to Halacha, you know what the Talmud says? A has to do this three times. He has to find three different times to ask forgiveness. After three times, then maybe he doesn't have to ask anymore. But a minimum amount of time you got to ask is three. Question if it's the same place, same location, same time. Could he ring the doorbell right away? He's got to wait another day. That's not for us today. That will do Erev Yom Kippur. But he has to do it three times. So he has to wait again and try a second time and come back to the guy and say, listen, I really want to apologize. Get the door slammed on his face a second time. He has not fulfilled his requirement. Two slammings in a door, not good enough. Got to do it a third time. There's always three times that you got to ask forgiveness. Now, let me ask you in reverse. If you're a good guy and you want to make the guy, the host, you want to make the person ask forgiveness, how many opportunities are you going to give him? Three times. So he comes over to Barkhamsa. He says, Barkhamsa, we're enemies. I think it's time to apologize. I'll pay for my meal. That's one time. He says, no good. Comes back to him and says, listen, I'm throwing you out. You got to do something. Okay. I'll pay for half the meal. That's the second time. Host says, no good. Not taking half the meal. Don't bribe me away. Don't bribe me. I want you to apologize. I want you to admit you made a mistake. Rabbis are on my side. They know I'm here. They're all here at this party because I'm the victim here. You got to do something. He says, okay. Three. I'm going to give you a third offer right now. You know what the third offer is? I pay for the entire meal. Three times? I'm not obligated anymore to do this anymore. If you ask someone for forgiveness three times, you're not obligated anymore to ask a fourth time. If I try to get you to ask for forgiveness three times and you keep on saying no, I'm not obligated a fourth time. Our conversation is over. There's nothing for me to discuss with you. Leave. And he kicked him out. The host here was trying to train Barkhamsa into doing the right thing. Was trying to tell Barkhamsa, don't bribe your way out of this mistake. Don't do that. actually asked forgiveness. Now, if you have to look at the story this way, even though we started with Bar Kamsa basically just being destroyed, it seems like not Bar Kamsa was a victim of the host, but Bar Kamsa is a real nasty human being. He's willing to pay for the full meal in order to avoid and say, I'm sorry. That's not a good thing. The host is 100% innocent. You know, I know he's innocent. All the rabbis showed up to his house. You know, I know the host is innocent because he goes to Bar Kamsa and says, listen, I don't want your money. I want you to say, I'm sorry. The host is, you know why we don't know the host's name? Because if we did know the host's name, everyone in this Zoom would say the host was a bad guy. The reason why we don't say the host's name, the rabbis did not list the name in the Talmud, is to tell us he's not guilty at all. He does not belong part of the story. We don't want to say the host, Mr. X, John Smith, is and Bar Kamsa destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. That means John Smith is a part of the perpetrator for the Beis Hamikdash being destroyed. The Talmud wants to tell us, no, the host did zero. Zero. We don't even know his name. You know why we don't know his name? He did nothing wrong at all. He's 100% a victim. 100% a victim. I want to know the guy's name. That's curiosity. I don't care. We're not telling you his name. Don't even think he did something wrong. He was a man who was a victim of the person and tried to make an overture piece three separate times. The person said, no, goodbye. We don't need this guy at my party. He's right for throwing the guy out. We don't deal with such people. Now, why does this come to us? It comes to us to teach us this lesson. By the way, the rabbis as well. Are the rabbis supposed to tell the host? By the way, you maybe go and apologize. You threw the guy out of the house. You know what that means? The rabbis are telling the host? The rabbis are telling the host, maybe sometimes taking money is not a bad idea. That's like one of the worst things a rabbi can be known as. Rabbis could do a lot of bad things, but if the rabbi is known as a guy that could be bribed, that, you know what, he looks at the money, yeah, he should have taken a whole meal. He should have taken a whole meal. Doesn't look good. Not a good idea. So the rabbis as well could not give the host any mussar whatsoever. Of course not. What are the rabbis supposed to tell the host? Take the money? That's terrible. So the rabbis acted honorably. The host acted honorably. And everyone here is in good standing except for who? Bar Kamsa, who refuses to apologize. He'd rather pay off the thing. And when he can't throw his money around, what does he do? He goes to the Roman government to get the entire Beis Hamikdash destroyed. So what happens is, when you want to say that the money is the problem, the love of the money, the cause of the money, the need for the money is an issue here. And that's something, sadly to say, that we deal with potentially overall, not to say bad about the Jews in the 9 days, but until today, that might be one of the issues Klai Yisrael is facing and why the Beis Hamikdash was not reinstated, rebuilt in our days. Hopefully in the next 2 days it will. Because on some level, our love for money is still greater than it should be. So we're going to tell you now another story. Where we're going to tell you the beginning of the story, the end of the story, and then we're going to see we missed some details here. And from the missing details, we're going to fill in what we have to learn from there. So just once again to make a small break, because I think as the Zoom goes on, I'm talking a little quicker than I started with. Is anyone have any questions right now, as of now, on the Bar Kamsa story and how we proved that Bar Kamsa was really about money and not about anything else? And we quoted the Jerusalem Talmud that says that money is the reason why the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. And therefore, till today, money might be the problem that we are working on, that we have to get rid of that love of money, not completely, but to a certain point, in order to rebuild the Beis Hamikdash nowadays. No questions at all. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you another story. There's a Mishnah in Masechta Avos. We might know this Mishnah. We're going to tell you the details of the Mishnah, and then we're going to tell you again to show what it means to have true love of money. So it says the story was of Yossi ben Kisma. I don't know how to spell it. I guess K-I-S-M-A. Yossi ben Kisma was walking down the street. He bumped into somebody. And again, every detail in these stories that is written, and certainly every detail that is not written, is extremely important to know. So Yossi ben Kisma is walking down the street, and he bumps into someone. And this person, Mr. X, Mr. Jones, tells Yossi ben Kisma, can you come to my town? He says, Rebbe, what's going on with you? He calls him a Rebbe. He reels right away, Yossi ben Kisma was holy. He says, Rebbe, can you come to my town? I will build you a yeshiva. You will be very successful. We will make it into a great place. And Yossi ben Kisma's response to this person was, I will only live in a place of Torah. Can't go to your place. Sorry. And therefore the Talmud learns from this idea that a person is supposed to move into a neighborhood that promotes spiritual growth. From Yossi ben Kisma. Since he turned down the $1 million Rosh Hashiva job, he could have got rid of all the issues in his life. He said, no, don't take it. I have to live in a place of only Torah study. The great Kli Chemda, late 1800s, early 1900s, was in America in the 1920s or 30s to collect money. And he said over this idea, amazingly, he asked a question. Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, when you read the story, a major detail is left out. He never said, ask the guy where he lives. The story says, the man approached him and said, can you come to my neighborhood? I will build you a shul and I will give you money and I will support you. And his answer was, no, I'll only live in a place of Torah. Shouldn't the story have said, Mr. Jones, where do you live? Maybe he lives in Bnei Brak. Maybe he lives in Yerushalayim. Maybe lives in the Old City. Maybe lives in Lakewood. Maybe lives in Flatbush, Five Towns, wherever it is. Maybe let's find out where it is. Before you say, I won't live in your place except in a place of Torah, give us the detail. Where did this guy come from? Why didn't it say it? So why would he say, you didn't even ask the guy where he lived. How do you know he doesn't live in a place of Torah? So the Kichemda gives a fascinating answer. Very, very important for all of us in psychology today. In every neighborhood in the world, there is something that they use as a selling point. So, for example, Colorado will be, you're near the ski slopes. Old City, you're closer to the coastal. Florida, you're closer to the beach. I guess nowadays with global warming, you're further from the beach. I'm not sure how it works anymore. But every place has a neighborhood that they're selling. You could be near this person. You could live next to this person. We have this. We have conveniences of Landau's. We have conveniences of food stores open 24/7. We have conveniences. You always sell what is your main point. Now, here, when the guy says, come to my neighborhood, and I'm going to start a yeshiva for you, what did he sell him? You know what he told him? I'm going to give you a lot of money. That means the selling point in that neighborhood was money. He told him, I can't live in a place except a place of Torah study, a place of Torah. It does not mean that they weren't learning Torah in that place where the person was. They probably were learning Torah. They wanted a new yeshiva. They're ready to pay for it. But what was the value system? What was the thing that's selling the most? You offer someone what you think you want to sell. So if I think it's money, I offer you money. If I think you don't want money, if you have a daughter in Shaduk, I tell you, listen, you know what I'm going to do for you? I'm going to set your daughter up guaranteed. I'll get your daughter married. That's a valuable deal. You'll take that deal. If you want to live next to the ski slopes, I'll sell you a place in Colorado. What you value is what I'm going to sell to you. So the same thing applies here as well. He said, you came to me and you offered me money. What that means is your selling point was money. If your selling point is money, it is not a place of Torah. It's a contradiction to Torah. What he's teaching us till today is it doesn't matter how many hours you actually study Torah. It doesn't matter how many hours you're learning and saying Tehillim. What's your value system? If your value system is money, it's great you're still learning Torah. It's great you're still davening. We're not against that. But know that you are a person of money. And on the other hand, there are people out there who are extremely monetarily successful on their own, through inheritances, whatever it is, but their value system is Torah. Their value system is rabbis. Their value system is gaining spirituality, improving on the spirituality daily. So the lesson is not necessarily, are you wealthy, are you not wealthy? It's not about what you have, but about what you want, what you sell. Do you want to improve spiritually? At what cost? At what price? What is your value system? What can you be bought at? When you're in your school as a young child, they tell you, you know how much pig costs in God's eyes to you? If I would give you $1,000 to eat pig and you say no, then when I offer you pig to eat and you say no, God counts it as $1,000. If I offer you $1 million, worth $1 million. All of these things are what you're willing to sell for. What are you willing to give up for a spiritual life? So what happened in the time of the Beis Hamikdash was, instead of saying I'm sorry, he said money is more valuable. Money is more valuable than saying I'm sorry. You know what happened because of that? The Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. What does the Jerusalem Talmud tell us? The love of money created hatred. The love of money doesn't mean having or not having it. The love of money means what is our value system. And that's something, which I wouldn't speak about anybody here, but that is something sadly, that might apply to people today. What is our value system? What do we truly admire? What do we truly want? Who are we truly jealous of? How does our life work? If our value system is money, then sadly to say, we are not repenting for the original sin of Kamta Bar Kamta. We're willing to do many things, then the Beis Hamikdash cannot be built in our days because we're still doing the same exact mistake. It's not an ancient thing. When we celebrate, not the word celebrate, but if that's the correct English term, when we're going to fast and act out the days of mourning these days, and especially on Tisha B'Av, it's not only we are mourning over past events, we are mourning over present day events. Those sins that the Gemara writes about are actually present within all of us. If it wasn't present within all of us, Mashiach would have come. So it is present within all of us. What are we learning from today's story, from the Kamta Bar Kamta story, is that people valued money over most things. And you have to think of your own life. You don't have to tell it to me. You have to think of your own life. What value system would you do for money? What would I give up? Would I make a shidduch with someone I don't want to make, even though I know they're not such good people, but I think my daughter and son will have a rich life? Will I live in a certain neighborhood because I like the way that the neighborhood is set up, even though it might not be well for me spiritual? All of these questions you have to ask yourself. Am I willing to pay money not to apologize to someone? Hopefully not. But we have to work on the value system of money being a very important factor in our life. Again, I'm not saying money is evil. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying the value system, what it can be used for, what it can be done for. If it's used to not apologize, then it's negative. If it's used to live in the wrong area, then it's negative. What we have to do in the next couple of days and work on ourselves is to work on minimizing the love of money, meaning when it's a detriment to our spirituality. A lot of us always believe if we won the lottery, many students tell me, if I won the lottery, the amount of charity I would give out would be unbelievable. Many, many students have said to me, I said, God doesn't need your charity. Don't worry about it. He'll figure out how to work the charity without you. Don't think he's giving you the lottery for your charity. He's giving you the lottery, if he does, because you deserve it for many, many, many reasons. And if he's not giving it to you, it's because it's not a good idea for you to have that lottery. Usually when you're dealing with younger people, if you'd give them that much money, you would see the negative results instantaneously, sadly to say. It wouldn't all be positive if they made that money. But the idea is that we have to work on this concept of money not being the idea. And we'll say another example of why we're in Gullus today. It says that when Yaakov was going down to Egypt, and he knew beforehand, based on prophecy, that the Jews were going to be in a very terrible exile. Probably, I wouldn't say probably, certainly even though we can't grasp the understanding of it, it was a worse exile than we are in today. Worse exile than the Holocaust, those 5 years of the Holocaust, much worse. The Egyptian exile was beyond our comprehension negativity. And he was going down there. He was headed down toward Egypt. You know what the Chumash says he did beforehand? He had Yosef there already. Yosef, his prized son, was there. Yosef, if you learn at the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, was his star student. He had taught all the secrets of the Torah to Yosef, all of them. But before he goes down to Egypt, you know what Yaakov does? Chumash tells us he did one thing that is not in Parshas Vayeshev, is in Parshas Vayigash. It says he sent down Yehuda ahead to build the yeshiva. So the question the commentators ask, why do you have to send Yehuda down to build the yeshiva? Yosef was there already. Yosef was his star student. And you know what Yosef had? He had access to take care of all the building codes, all the lunch programs. Yosef was the head of Egypt. He could set up a yeshiva in literally 5 seconds. No one was going to go against Yosef on being able to grease the wheels and getting all the documents signed, all the red tape erased. Why did he have to send down Yehuda when Yosef was the prize student and Yosef had all the access to take care of everything? So some rabbis say, you know why? Because Yehuda was being sent down because Yaakov was telling Yehuda like this, I want you to go down. I want you to be there completely on the idea that you will do Torah without the money of Yosef. Because the moment Yosef's money gets involved with the building, the Egyptian money gets involved, it's already now a Torah with money at its head. I don't want that. I want you to go down and have pure Torah. The money could corrupt it. Not always does money corrupt it, but it could corrupt it. Even Yosef, his star student, even Yosef can take care of the red tape, I don't want that. I don't want the Egyptian government involved with this. I want you to go down by yourself. Well, we have to, that was Yaakov telling us today in exile. You're going down to an exile. You know how you survive an exile? When you make it spiritual, you make a Torah study without the influence of money. Many years ago, I'll end with the story, and then we can answer questions. Many years ago, I was sitting in a meeting with a very holy Jew, still alive. No one knows him. He wants to remain unknown. And they were discussing opening a shul for this person. And there were a few of us around, and I was sitting there quietly. I was younger, probably about 20 years than everybody else in the room. And they were all discussing with this rabbi that we're going to start a shul. We're going to have a kollel with a yeshiva. This is going on. He wasn't saying a word. He was quiet there, completely uninterested, I might add. But he was sitting there quietly. And the conversation was going on for about 6-7 minutes of what they were going to do, how they were going to build it, this, that. Finally, one person said, listen, all the money will be taken care of. There's nothing to worry about. I know a guy who's going to pay for it. It's all taken care of. And at that moment, the rabbi sitting next to me got up and said, okay, I just want to tell you, I will not take this gig. I want to thank you for the offer. It was very nice. It's not for me. And he walked out. So I was walking out with him. I went out with him and I asked him, whoa, that was a pretty abrupt ending to the meeting here. What's going on? He said, I was waiting to see who was involved with this shul being built. Was it the Yetzer Tov, evil, the good inclination, or the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination? He said, I wasn't sure. On one hand, these guys were really excited about opening a shul. I know I can contribute. I know it would be a good idea. I know if I would be able to run a kollel, it would be a good idea for my life as well. But I wasn't sure. I was getting a bad energy. I wasn't. As soon as I heard that person say, oh, don't worry, all the money's taken care of, I knew it was coming from a bad place. I knew money was being involved. Money was the main factor. And this is not for us to understand on our level. But at his level, he recognized that as soon as the money was being thrown in his face, it was coming from the evil inclination. What we have to do is, in the next few days in our life, the lifelong work, we have to realize that having money is not necessarily bad. But what do we value? Are we going to have money instead of saying, I'm sorry? Are we going to have money and do the bad things with it? Not necessarily do bad things, avoid things. And the rabbis were saying in the story of Kamsa Bar Kamsa, we're not going to tell the host any mussar. You know why? Because the host showed that money does not count over you being a good person apologizing. That's more valuable to me. Apologize. Fix yourself up. Say you're sorry. You don't want to do it? Don't come to my party. I don't need you. I don't want to see you. I throw you out. The idea we got to work on to the exile today, and hopefully we can do it in the next couple of days, I wish everyone good luck at this. It's a lifelong thing, especially in America. The Golden Medina, which is like the worst phrase we could have. It means everything's all about the city streets of gold, paved with gold. It means that the value system in America is gold. And we're living in a system that everyone seems to value such a thing. And we have to really work on ourselves to value the right things and not let the money getting our way, of avoiding us doing what it's our responsibility, whether it be apologizing or building a shul, having a rabbi that we can take upon ourselves, whatever it is. We cannot let the money help us avoid our spiritual responsibility. And hopefully, as I said earlier, we get to sing the story of Eicha in the next couple of days in Yerushalayim in a massive, massive celebration. Thank you all again.